From Montpelier, Vermont, this is Public Health Radio. With no major proposals coming from the federal government for nearly 15 years to meaningfully address the problems of high cost and poor access to health care in the U.S., several states across the country have begun developing reform plans to try to address the crisis at the state level. Joining us today to discuss two of the most prominent proposals are Dave Himmelstein and Judy Dugan, both experts on the health insurance industry. They'll discuss the reform programs developed in Massachusetts and California, which have received a great deal of attention by media and other state governments across the nation. But first, some news from the world of public health.
This is Public Health Radio. I'm Andrew Coates, together with Elaine Hills. Here now some news from the world of public health.
The world will continue to rapidly shift to warmer temperatures with new wind patterns, more frequent heat waves, more intense tropical cyclones, increased drought in some regions, heightened precipitation levels in other regions, rising global average sea levels, and continued melting glaciers and sea ice. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or IPCC, reported this month that the Earth is unequivocally warming as a result of human-induced changes in the atmosphere, oceans, glaciers, and ice caps. The IPCC assessment reflects the conclusions of 600 authors from more than 40 countries. The report revealed a rapid rise in the greenhouse gases carbon dioxide, methane, and nitrous oxide in the past 250 years. The level of greenhouse gases seen today exceeds the natural range of greenhouse gases recorded in ice cores that show the last 650,000 years of the Earth's greenhouse gas history. Fossil fuel use and agricultural practices, in particular livestock production, are the human activities most responsible for the rapid changes in greenhouse gas emissions. Since the first recorded climate records in 1850, 11 of the last 12 years were reported as among the 12 warmest years on record. Data on 80 glaciers across the world, collected by the World Glacier Monitoring Service, show that between 2000 and 2005, the amount of glacial ice lost was 1.6 times the amount of glacial ice that melted in the 1990s and about 3 times the rate of glacial ice melt in the 1980s. For more information and to read a copy of the report, visit the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change's website at www.ipcc.ch.
The United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees has called for $60 million in emergency funding to help fleeing Iraqis. 40,000 to 50,000 people flee Iraq each month. More than 3.8 million Iraqis have either fled the country or fled their homes, according to the United Nations. Syria has taken in an estimated 1 million Iraqis. Jordan, more than 700,000. Egypt, more than 130,000. All countries in the region are moving to restrict immigration from Iraq. The United States of America has taken in 466 Iraqis since 2003. An editorial published February 9th by the international business newspaper The Financial Times calls for funding the UNHCR. They conclude, quote, "The U.S. and U.K. should reconsider their refugee admission policies, since without their foreign policies, these people would not be refugees."
A new vaccine for HPV, the human papillomavirus, has precipitated controversy. The vaccine is effective against the types of HPV that cause about 70% of cervical cancers. Each year, nearly 500,000 women worldwide are found to have cervical cancer. Of these, roughly half will die of the disease. Importantly, the vaccine will not remove the need for preventive examinations and pap smears and will require special education materials about HPV. In 2006, the Food and Drug Administration approved for public use the HPV vaccine made by Merck and Company. The retail price Merck charges for the vaccine is $120 a dose. Since three doses are required, it costs $360 per patient for the vaccine. The company is expected to reap $1 billion in sales of the vaccine in the coming year. Now the company has begun aggressively lobbying states to make the vaccine mandatory for young girls. Early this year, Texas was the first state to do so. The company is also lobbying to require Medicare and Medicaid to pay the retail price for the vaccine. If the vaccine were mandatory in the United States, some predict that Merck could sell $4 billion of the product annually.
President Bush proposes to cut funding for health insurance for the children of low-income families. Since 2000, 6.8 million Americans have lost their health insurance. However, during the same period of time, the percentage of low-income children without health insurance declined from 20% in 2000 to 14% in 2005. This has been thanks to two programs, the State Children's Health Insurance Program, known as SCHIP, and Medicaid, both programs that are funded by a combination of state and federal funds. 6 million children are covered by SCHIP programs. The Congressional Research Service estimated that to continue to insure this number of children over the next 5 years, $15 billion in new funding would be needed. The White House, however, proposed only $4.8 billion for that period of time, far short of the funding required. The Bush administration proposal would further limit SCHIP eligibility to children and families with annual incomes less than 200% of the federal poverty level. Although SCHIP programs have been successful in reducing the number of children without health insurance, the programs have begun to have difficulties. In Georgia, the SCHIP program there, called Peach Care for Kids, will freeze enrollment in March 2007. The program insures 273,000 children, but faces a $57 million deficit.
Coming up next on Public Health Radio, the health reform plans in California and Massachusetts.
This is Public Health Radio. I'm Marvin Malik, host for today's show. Year after year, the U.S. healthcare system continues to perform poorly. We have worse public health outcomes than most every other developed country, as measured by life expectancy, disability rates, infant mortality, and many other measures. Year after year, we spend double the per capita average of the other developed countries. And while in every other developed nation, every citizen has comprehensive health coverage, here in the U.S., the quality of coverage for most Americans worsens each year, with most Americans experiencing ever higher deductibles, copays, and coverage exclusions. And a growing number of Americans have no coverage at all. The number currently exceeds 47 million. Despite this stunning degree of dysfunction, the issue of health care had hardly been mentioned by the Bush administration in its first 6 years. Faced with apparent neglect nationally, more and more states are attempting to solve some of the problems in the U.S. health care system by proposing reforms at the state level. Among the various states that have enacted reforms of their health systems, the mainstream press and pundits across the U.S. are characterizing the plan proposed by Governor Schwarzenegger in California and the plan passed into law in Massachusetts last year as especially significant landmark achievements that will move the U.S. much closer to achieving universal health care. But the question is the media hype that has surrounded these plans justified? Joining us today to discuss the Massachusetts and California health proposals are Dave Himmelstein and Judy Dugan. Dave Himmelstein is a practicing internist, an associate professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School, and chief of the Division of Social and Community Medicine at Cambridge Hospital. He has published more than 100 journal articles and 3 books, most of them focusing on access to medical care, medical bankruptcy, and the feasibility of national health insurance. In 1987, he co-founded Physicians for a National Health Program, a national organization with over 14,000 healthcare workers that advocates for a single-payer, universal healthcare system for the United States. Judy Dugan is the director of research at the Foundation for Taxpayer and Consumer Rights. Until March 2006, she was a senior editorial writer and deputy editor of the Los Angeles Times editorial page. Her commentaries on the California state government won her the Pulitzer Prize in 2004 and 3 national awards from the Association of Opinion Page Editors during the 1990s. Her research areas have focused on health insurance and the oil industry. Judy Dugan and Dave Himmelstein, welcome to Public Health Radio.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
According to the media coverage, the state of Massachusetts has gone a step beyond what many of the other states in the U.S. has done. And the claim is that the new reform bill in Massachusetts will actually provide health insurance coverage for every citizen of the state. So, Dave Himmelstein, I'm wondering if you can describe the bill passed last year in Massachusetts.
Well, really what the state has done is to say to people, you have to go out and buy coverage, and they've said we're going to tell the insurance companies they should make affordable, comprehensive coverage available, and the line that was given when they were passing it is, we'll have great policies available to people for $200 a month. Actually, that hasn't happened, and it can't happen, because if you leave the existing healthcare system intact and you just say to the insurance companies, we want you to provide the coverage, they charge what they charge to people today. And even for a stripped-down policy, it turns out, it's $380 a month for a single person. And with $5,000 deductible before your insurance even kicks in. So basically, the state government is saying to people, you have to buy coverage, you have to lay out $4,500 a year for what is a pretty poor policy. And as that reality has begun to hit, the understanding in the state is beginning to build that this is really a fake program. Now, they did do something for very poor people. They said, we're going to expand Medicaid to give free coverage to people below the poverty level and partial subsidies for people between 100 and 300% of poverty. But even with that partial coverage, it's more than most near poor people in our state can really afford. So it made good PR for our governor, who was getting ready to run for president, to say he'd passed a universal health care bill. But we call it the Marie Antoinette bill. It's a version of go tell people to buy it themselves, let them buy their own coverage. And it's quite clearly not going to work.
They're subsidizing people who are relatively low income to buy private insurance. Is that the notion?
Right. Virtually all of the new coverage comes from private insurance companies. So for people between 100% and 300% of poverty, so for a single person between $10,000 and $30,000 income, they're offering partial subsidy to go out and buy coverage. But even with that partial subsidy, the coverage still costs more than most of those folks can actually afford.
So to summarize, the key points in the Massachusetts bill are some expansion of Medicaid, meaning taxpayer expense in the existing system to cover more people, and then a mandate that every person has to buy health insurance coverage, or they'll be penalized somehow? How does that work?
That's right. The first year, there's a $200 fine if you don't buy health insurance coverage. And after that, the fine goes up to half of the cost of a policy. So it looks like it'll be about a $2,000 or $2,500 a year fine for anyone who doesn't have coverage, if they actually implement the bill. And it's now looking doubtful that they'll get around to it.
Now, many people who work, who are fortunate who work, have employers that offer health insurance and may pay for a portion of it or even most of it. And in Massachusetts, if you're being required to purchase health insurance, is that letting employers off the hook, or are employers somehow going to be encouraged to continue to, those employers who are providing coverage, is Massachusetts going to try to encourage them to continue to do so?
Well, there's a small fine for employers who don't provide coverage. It's a couple hundred dollars a year. But for most employers, it's clearly going to be cheaper not to provide the coverage. And there are some very weak measures to try and keep them doing it. But basically, it's just a couple hundred dollars a year to get out of providing coverage. And even then, if you offer to pay for half of a lousy policy, you get out of even that $200 fine for an employer. So there are very weak measures for encouraging employers to continue coverage.
And they're also going to make health insurance tax deductible, which it hasn't normally been. Is that right?
Yeah, so there's some tax help for people to buy it. Most of that, of course, is useful to high-income people, because tax deduction doesn't do very much for someone who's in a low tax bracket who's not making much money, whereas it's worth a fair amount of money to someone who's in a high tax bracket. The problem, of course, is there aren't many uninsured people in the high tax bracket.
By making the purchase of private health insurance, in other words, buying from a private company, tax deductible, you're favoring that purchase. In fact, the whole point of the Massachusetts plan is they're mandating that you purchase health insurance from a private company, meaning that a lot of taxpayer dollars in the form of that tax deduction are basically going to these private health insurance companies. So I'm wondering, did the state, when they basically expanded the role of private health insurance in the state with this bill, are they restricting what they can do? For example, just to give an obvious question, are they saying that the CEO of an insurance company can no longer earn more than $4 million, or is there anything to limit the freedom of private health insurance companies?
No, not at all. And you've put your finger on exactly what's going on here, Marvin. In effect, this bill is a huge gift to the private insurance companies in our state. For the first time in history that I'm aware of, a government is saying to people, you must buy a product from a private firm. Not you have to contribute to taxes that help provide a service, but you must buy a product, and a defective product, from one of the few private firms that sell it, and virtually no restrictions on those private companies and what they can pay their CEOs or others. Not only that, there's already been an issue now in the state, because it turns out that the new bureaucracy they set up to administer the program is going to take about 4% of every new premium that's sold just for that new state bureaucracy, which is paying its bureaucrats at a higher rate than any other state worker. So the head of the new insurance commission, so-called connector, is making almost $250,000 a year, and there are several members of his staff over $100,000 a year. So they're making more than the governor, and that income is going to come out of the pockets of the people who are forced to buy these new policies. And they've already announced that the way they're going to fund that new bureaucracy is a 4% surcharge on the insurance policies that are being sold.
I'd like to, just in a second, I'd like to turn to the California plan, but I was wondering if you could just lay out quickly what your concerns are about this plan and what you think is likely to occur.
Well, a couple of concerns about it. One is that it does absolutely nothing to rein in the rapidly rising healthcare costs in our state. We're already the most expensive healthcare system in the world in Massachusetts, and this plan doesn't restrict any of that and doesn't take any of the fat out of the system. In fact, it adds more. Instead of saying to private insurance companies, you're charging us 15% overhead for every policy you sell, they're just adding this new state bureaucracy to it. Instead of streamlining the bureaucracy for hospitals and doctors that drains a huge amount out of our system, they're leaving all of that intact. And instead of giving incentives for more efficient delivery of health care. They're saying we're just going to leave things as they are, and we're going to trust the private insurers who have created the problems we have to run the health care system. As long as our health care costs keep going up, the reason that there are so many uninsured people is going to stay in our system. Basically, people don't have coverage because they can't afford it. And just telling them you should go out and buy it isn't going to solve that problem. So next year, costs will be 8% higher than they were this year, and the year after, 8% above that. And more people are going to get priced out of the market. And the only thing that will have been accomplished is to cover a very few very poor people and to line the pockets of the insurance industry with dollars that the state legislature has put there. So my concern is that this is not a viable solution to the crisis in our healthcare system. My guess is that it falls apart yet again. I mean, we passed what was advertised as a universal healthcare program in our state in 1988, and Mike Dukakis was running for president. And back then, we said this can't work. There's no cost containment, and there will be a rebellion against it. Not only that, but just as the economy goes sour, the Medicaid rolls swell because more people are poor and losing their jobs and losing their health insurance, and there's no way to fund that. And the same problem with this current system. The current program will fold very quickly, and we'll be back trying to figure out what to do about our healthcare system when we know very well what can be done. It's a single-payer system, a national health insurance system, which would replace the private insurance companies with a single public program and cut out most of their overhead, simplify billing and bureaucracy for doctors and hospitals, and save billions and billions of dollars on that, and improve coverage for most people of our state for what we're now spending.
All right, I'd like now to turn to the state of California and welcome Judy Dugan to the discussion. I was recently watching one of the Talking Heads shows, and they were basically saying that this was a couple of days after Arnold Schwarzenegger, the governor of California, announced his plan to insure everyone in the state of California. And they basically said that it's too bad he wasn't born in the United States, because he would be a shoo-in for president because of this new health care plan that he's proposed. And that's the quality of the press coverage we've received, that California is really going to be the wave of the future. So please do tell us about the plan that your governor out there in California has announced.
Basically, the Schwarzenegger Health Plan is the Massachusetts plan on steroids. It has most of the same faults that David talked about, only it covers a much larger population. First of all, it's good to see politicians talking about universal health care. But what we're seeing is that California will have the same failures that Massachusetts is having, only it will have them in a much bigger dimension. California has 6.7 million uninsured people, whereas Massachusetts, I believe, has only about 500,000. Our private insurance system is far less regulated than Massachusetts already is. So the governor's plan, which is entirely dependent on private insurance companies, has no credible cost containment. So we're interpreting this, unless major changes are made, as an enormous profit engine for private insurance companies.
Well, now, describe the plan, if you don't mind.
It is based on, as Massachusetts is, an individual mandate. It requires people who do not currently have insurance through their employer or through a private company to purchase private insurance on the private market if they are over a certain threshold of income, which is not very high. It's under $30,000 for an individual and $60,000 for a family of four.
And they face a penalty if they don't do that?
They face a tax penalty. That's not quite settled yet. They would certainly face the loss of their standard deductions on their state income tax, which is substantial in California. The plan also, as in Massachusetts, has a penalty for employers who do not offer insurance. It is under the governor's plan. somewhat higher. It would be 4% of Social Security payroll. But given that any decent employer plan usually costs the employer 8 to 10% of payroll, that's not a great incentive for keeping insurance. It's a little better than Massachusetts, but it is not sufficient. There would be mechanisms for covering more children under the state federal children's health insurance program and for offering coverage to people without children who are actually under the poverty level. It has a number of moving pieces, but the one piece of it that is likely to undercut the plan altogether is the dependence on the private insurance market, because the state, as well as ordinary systems, will still be buying from the private market. The plan does have a requirement, which California does not have now, that all plans must spend 85% of premium dollars on medical care. Currently in California, in the individual market, we've got Blue Cross spending only 50% of premium dollars on medical care, the rest on incredibly wasteful overhead and stunning profits, and far too little on the actual medical care. So the problem is going to be what Massachusetts has run into, only it will be much more severe here when you get to that barrier where individuals have to buy their own insurance, that income line. You'll get somebody who's $1 over that income line having to pay four times as much as the percentage of income for far inferior insurance. One of the things we're beginning to see already, and which I understand Massachusetts is seeing, is insurance companies demanding that they be allowed to design plans that are virtually unregulated, with much higher deductibles than Massachusetts certainly envisioned, with fewer things covered in the insurance, with payments that may be capped at far less than the actual cost of services like hospital, and an easing or elimination of out-of-pocket caps altogether, which could leave people with hundreds of thousands of dollars of medical debt instead of just $10,000 or $20,000.
The same question I asked Dave. You're basically fostering an expansion of the private health insurance market by forcing people to purchase, but you're saying that that the governor in California is not planning on regulating these insurance companies other than this 15%?
No, he is also going to do something that Massachusetts, Vermont, New York, several other states do, which is to require insurers to take all comers, to sell policies. They cannot reject someone who wants to buy a policy outright, as they do now. They can reject you if you have acne. They can reject you if you have a toenail fungus. This is true. They'll reject you if you're in a public safety job like firefighting. You simply cannot buy individual insurance in California if you take Lipitor, one of the more common drugs for cholesterol.
So you're saying there won't be a pre-existing condition clause, is that?
Right, and he wants community ratings, that you buy your insurance based on broad communities, perhaps broad age groups. As it is right now, they can literally sell you an individual insurance policy based on your own personal medical condition and excluding coverage for a medical condition that you may already have. There are people who can be paying thousands of dollars a month if they're trying to buy on the individual market, if they can get insurance at all. So his proposal would change that. But that does not change the overall profit mode of the insurance system. And in fact, even the 85% of spending on medical care rule doesn't do it, because what that does, it's a perverse incentive unless rates are regulated, because insurance companies will be willing to pay more to doctors and hospitals to charge more for the policies so they can gather more overall dollars within the 15% cap on their administrative costs.
Well, let's take a short break. I'm Marvin Malik, and this is Public Health Radio. After the break, we'll return to California to discuss Governor Schwarzenegger's proposal for universal health care. And then we'll look at the proposal President Bush put forth in his recent State of the Union address. So stay tuned. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. Our guests today are Judy Dugan and Dave Himmelstein, two experts on the health insurance dilemma in the United States. And we've been talking about the health reform bills in California and Massachusetts. Now back to the interview. In California, it sounded to me like in reading the text of the bill, there were a variety of things that the governor was trying to do to achieve cost containment. And I was wondering if you could summarize those and give me a prediction about whether you think that'll work. Because Dave points out that in Massachusetts, he thinks that's where one of the areas where the Massachusetts bill will probably fail and lead to the dissolution.
Yeah. But in terms of cost containment, the methods are all indirect. Things like medical records technology, and also making billing one system instead of the fragmented system that we have now, where the front office of any doctor's group is six people trying to figure out which code to put on which insurance claim. These are all reasonable things, but we've seen the problems that other groups have encountered in trying to get overall medical technology and medical reporting and medical records online. Aside from the obvious privacy problems, there have been tremendous breakdowns that have been reported, for instance, at Kaiser Hospitals in California, which were trying to pioneer full electronic medical records. It's a lot easier to say you're going to do this than to do this, especially on a statewide level.
And I don't believe that there's any proof of that will actually control costs. Is that true?
I think it increases efficiency to a certain degree, but the cost controls are unproven because it's so expensive to put these things in.
Right.
And there's a lot of jawboning that goes on in these proposals, most of which are not in the formal final legislation yet, in terms of the state, in one proposal, bargaining with insurers for better rates on the basis of its volume. But that's unproven in every way, and you don't get prices down without having teeth and regulatory authority.
You're saying they were going to regulate hospital fees? Is that part of the proposal, too? Because as I read it, it sounded like they were contemplating that.
Well, it's not exactly that. What they're actually going to do is raise the payments to hospitals and doctors for Medicaid patients. Rates had been so low that doctors were bailing wholesale out of the system. Under the Schwarzenegger proposal, they're also going to charge hospitals a sort of fee. They won't call it a tax. They're calling it a fee, 4% of revenue. And doctors would have to put 2% of revenue back into the system.
Now, that I suspect, I suspect that if they're levying a 4% fee on total hospital gross revenue, I suspect that's a lot of money. It must have been a large portion of the plan, was it not?
Yeah, it is. It's a large portion of the state's cost of covering people who are currently uncovered.
Now,
Have the hospitals bought onto that? Are they objecting, or is this going over?
They are hanging back at the moment. It's a trade-off for them. It's not all downside, because they would be getting greater repayment for Medicaid patients, which are a large part of many hospitals' population. They would also, if this were to go right, and that's such a big if, would be trading in their completely unreimbursed patients for patients with some form of insurance.
Right, and then improving the rates for the Medicaid. So between the uninsured and Medicaid, the hospitals would be gaining money, and then you're saying they're going to lose 4% off the top.
Yeah, the governor is arguing that they'd have a total gain, and the hospitals are still in the calculating stage.
Now, Dave, this really contrasts with Massachusetts, where I was quite surprised to learn that, unlike California, which is at least putting some levy on hospital gross revenue, which you'd expect to increase, in Massachusetts, it's the reverse. They're actually paying more money to hospitals to get this, to get to have enacted this bill?
Yeah, part of the deal in Massachusetts was that they put a substantial rate increase in for the hospitals. And basically, again, it's part of why this program can't fly long term, because you know, you take a hospital like Massachusetts General Hospital, our biggest hospital, that's already profiting $100 million a year on their system, and then you throw more money at them and charge people who can't afford premiums more, that just doesn't work. So you're right, Marvin. They did put more money on the table for the hospitals, and part of it is clearly they were counting on a one-time infusion of federal money. So the federal government offered them several hundred million dollars for the next 2 years if they did a program like this, but that money goes away after the first 2 years.
When I hear about these proposals, this idea of an individual mandate, achieving universal health care by basically saying that everybody, you're going to buy a health insurance policy or you're going to be penalized, face a tax levy or whatever. To be honest, since they don't seem to threaten any of the powerful interests, they don't threaten the hospitals, they don't threaten the insurance companies, they wouldn't seem to threaten the doctors, it seems like an obvious thing to have been done. And I'd like to know how it is that this type of proposal never came up in the past and why you think it's cropping up right now. And if it has happened in the past, Dave, you mentioned the Dukakis plan in 87 or 88. Is that the only other example of this notion of an individual mandate bill, or has this happened before?
Well, the Dukakis plan was actually an employer mandate mostly. So mostly it required employers to pay for coverage for their workers. And the only group that had an individual mandate in that plan was college students, who were required to buy coverage and still are in our state. That's the one group that's supposedly had universal coverage, though it hasn't actually been enforced by and large. But Washington State back in the early 90s passed a universal mandate that combined employer payments and an individual mandate. But again, that was never implemented. So it's not entirely fresh, but it never has actually happened anywhere.
So there's no precedent for this working?
No, but I mean, in a way, President Bush is proposing the same thing at the federal level. He's saying...
Well, let's go ahead and describe that. For listeners who have not been following the news, January 23rd, President Bush presented his seventh State of the Union message and for the first time made what he announced to be a very major proposal to expand the number of people with health insurance. So, Dave, you were about to describe that bill, so go right ahead.
Well, essentially, the main proposal is to say, if you have health insurance, you get a $7,500 tax deduction if you're a single person, $15,000 a year if you have a family. And in essence, what that's saying is, if you don't have health insurance, you lose this large automatic tax deduction. Now, the Bush plan clearly won't do much for people who don't have health insurance, because most of them are poor, and a tax deduction, which is worth a lot for a wealthy person, isn't worth very much for a poor person. So it's probably a couple hundred dollars to someone who's making $15,000 a year, not nearly enough to afford coverage. But what it does do is to give a big tax break to wealthy people who are currently not getting as big a tax break for their coverage, or the very few wealthy people who are uninsured today will get a substantial tax break to help them buy coverage. So it's incredibly regressive and unlikely to help many people who actually are uninsured to buy it.
And no cost control, I assume.
Well, the piece that he says is cost control is that if you buy more than $7,500 worth of health insurance for an individual or $15,000 for a family, that you can't take a tax break any bigger than the $7,500 that you get automatically. So he says that'll keep people from buying these gold-plated policies, I think is the term they're using, and it'll make them shop more wisely. The problem, of course, is it's not, by and large, high-priced executives who are buying very expensive insurance. It's sicker and older people, because if you go out and buy coverage if you're 22 years old and healthy, you can find cheap coverage. But if you've got high blood pressure and high cholesterol and you go try and find coverage, you're going to pay $8,000, $10,000, $15,000 for an individual policy, and that's who's going to be paying extra taxes under the Bush plan. So it's really a plan to subsidize the wealthy to help them buy coverage, and to penalize the sick and old who are going to be paying more for their coverage and therefore getting less tax advantage under this Bush plan.
One other point on that one is that Bush said there would be some sort of inflation factor, but it would only go up with general inflation, not with medical inflation. So like the alternative minimum tax, the benefit that exists for a couple of years would be gone as soon as medical inflation overtook those tax credit limits. You know, the average policy for a family of four that costs $11,000 today, and that's just an average policy, not a, quote, gold-plated policy, as Bush put it, will soon cost over $15,000, and families will be paying a penalty instead of getting a benefit.
You know, I have to say, on the other side of this is the notion of gold-plated plans, which is the rhetoric that we've heard from the Bush administration, and they want to discourage people who they're characterizing as having lavish health plans. And I have to say that I have a personal friend who's a very talented scientist, he's a chemist, and his case to me was very poignant. He said that he's taken a job with the state of Vermont, and his salary is far lower than it would be in the private sector, most likely. But he has children, and he decided that he's so first of all, he does like his job, but says that he can find jobs he likes elsewhere too. But he felt so strongly that he wanted his family to have secure health insurance. And he just felt that the U.S. healthcare system doesn't provide health security. And so he ended up taking a job for the state of Vermont, and now he's got very high quality health coverage that's stable, and he's going to probably pay a lot of money if the Bush plan passes, because his plan presumably would be rated at more than $15,000 a year. He may have to pay more in taxes, because as it is now, employer-sponsored insurance is totally tax-deductible. So it's kind of odd that the insecurity people feel in the United States may actually, the people who've acted on that, pushing for security, may actually lose out. And I was wondering if you've had other people who are concerned about that.
Oh, I think that's clearly the case. And I mean, the other groups that you have, I mean, for instance, I guess now on Newsweek website is a man from Colorado who has a young child with hemophilia. And because that child's medical care has been extraordinarily expensive, he works for a small computer firm. Is apparently a skilled computer engineer, but that small group's premiums have skyrocketed, and it's not just for him, but everybody in the firm is paying high premiums because of his kid, and all of them would pay tax penalties if the president's plan passes. basically because of this kid with hemophilia. So it's both people who offer security and people, for instance, in this company, who've said, we're not going to leave this family out in the cold. We're all willing to try and chip in and help this kid out. They get penalized as well. So it's a ridiculous plan. Frankly, more a gesture than a plan. It's really, I think, giving it too much credence to call it a plan. Even the Bush people are saying maybe you cover 3 million or 5 million of the uninsured, 47 million uninsured. I think 3 million to 5 million is an outlandishly high estimate. So it doesn't really cover the uninsured. What it is a covert way to give more tax breaks to wealthy, healthy people. The other piece of his proposal, by the way, is to take money away from safety net providers, public hospitals and nursing homes that care for a lot of uninsured people. They've been getting some extra money from Medicaid programs, and Bush wants to take that money away and give it to the states to do so-called innovative programs. No guarantee that these programs are actually going to help the uninsured, but what we do know is that it'll take it away from the desperately in trouble institutions around this country that currently care for the uninsured. I mean, in Chicago right now, Cook County Hospital, the hospital that cares for the uninsured in that city, is facing $100 million cuts this year. They're going to close 17 of the 27 outpatient clinics available to poor people around the city of Chicago because funding is already being cut back, and Bush wants to cut that back more.
Year after year, the data are actually quite striking. If you look at longevity of men or women, the United States lags behind the other developed countries. We lag behind in infant mortality. We're the country that has millions and millions of people uninsured. Dave, you're saying it's up to 47 million now. I don't doubt that that's correct at this point. And yet, we're also the country that spends twice as much per capita as the international average of these wealthy countries. So it's really quite striking that the U.S. has a very different type of healthcare system than the rest of these countries. And I'm just wondering if these two bills in Massachusetts and California that have gotten so much press attention, really very favorable press attention, have these bills shown that they've learned something by comparing our system to the systems that other countries use, other developed countries?
Well, I think quite clearly not. If anything, what the Massachusetts bill says is we're going to ignore every lesson from every other country about how to do things better, and we're going to continue down this same road we're on, leave the private insurance industry in charge of the healthcare system, and that's the central problem with our healthcare system. We're not going to drive down the outrageous profits and incomes being made in the healthcare system. We're going to still let Jack Rowe, who worked as the CEO of Aetna, who made $225,000 a day during the entire time he was the CEO of that company, including nights and weekends. We're going to let that kind of thing continue to go on, or Bill McGuire at United Healthcare, who made $1.6 billion as the chief executive of that health insurance company. We're going to keep the drug industry making outrageous profits. So there's been a lot of discussion in the U.S. about importing Canadian drugs, which is kind of a bizarre thing to talk about because most of those Canadian drugs actually come from the United States. And really what we're saying is we want to re-import our own drugs, and why not just import Canadian prices, which is much simpler, makes much more sense. And they get good prices because they have a reasonable system of organizing their healthcare system, national health insurance, where the government essentially bargains with the drug companies and says, we're not just going to pay whatever you charge. We're going to bargain for decent prices. And as a result, they get prices about 40% below what we get, which our VA system gets as well. So we could do far better than Canadians do, or than people in Sweden or Denmark or any of the European systems you could talk about. But only if we're going to adopt their lessons. And the central lesson is there's no place for a profit-making private health insurance industry. And we need government to run a national health insurance program. We know that's how to do it. But the health insurance industry has tremendous financial clout, and they're out to stop their business from being taken away. And as long as you leave them in business, we can't have a decent healthcare system.
Judy, is it true that Governor Schwarzenegger received $1 million in campaign contributions from the health insurance industry last year?
Yes, that's true. He is. It was, by our count, $995,000, so nearly $1 million.
Well, I hope he's able to get the other $5,000 soon.
I haven't checked in the last week, so I'm sure he's over that by now. They must be very grateful to him. The one thing about the universal coverage that is truly universal, we did have a bill by a state senator, Sheila Kuhl, who has been on this topic for years, that would have provided a Medicare-like system for all of California. It did actually pass the legislature last year, but it was widely known that the governor would veto it. So the idea is not, it's not gone in California. The same legislator is going to bring up that bill again this year. And the best outcome would be to realize, as they start crunching the numbers, that it will never come out if you're doing it within this extremely fragmented, private, profit-oriented system.
Judy, it sounds like you and Dave are in broad agreement about the enormous benefit of bringing everyone into a single risk pool, so-called single-payer health care. But from reading some of your editorial pieces, I did get the impression that you see some benefit in enacting more incremental reforms. And I'm wondering if that's true.
Incremental steps may be small, but some of them can be effective in pointing out the need for something far more efficient by having people understand that we're only getting a small benefit out of this step we're taking, such as regulating rates, such as limiting the number of plan designs that insurance companies could come up with. They lead in the direction of a more unified system. And I think at this point in time, we're not going to get the great leap. And if we can get small improvements, medium improvements, that point in that direction and do actually insure more people without causing a revolt of some kind, that we have made progress. It's not a big goal, but it's a goal that I think we can move forward on with the right smaller steps.
Dave, Judy was just saying that she thinks that more significant regulation of the private health insurance companies would help or move things along for the next stage in a perhaps an incremental route. Do you see any hope for that?
Frankly, I don't. I mean, we had one of the more regulated systems in the country in Massachusetts, and we have the highest health care costs of any state. And what we know is that the insurance industry has so much legislative clout that when you try and start to regulate them, they very quickly squirm around it and come out the edges and get what they want anyway. They've done it with Medicare, which is essentially having the kind of competitive program that Judy's talking about, with a public system that says, well, you can go to a private insurer if you want. And the private insurers have gotten Congress to pay them vast amounts more than Medicare. So a Medicare patient who signs up with a private HMO, now the government will pay their premium. And the ideology was, we'll make them compete and we'll drive costs down. But in fact, what's happened is the private insurers can't compete with Medicare, but what they can do is to get Medicare to pay them outlandishly high rates. So if you go into a private HMO, you're costing our government 11% at least more than if you stayed in the traditional Medicare program. And we're spending billions of dollars each year to keep Medicare HMOs in business. And I think the evidence is very strong that their lobbying clout will circumvent any of those kinds of regulations, and that it's not a step towards really solving the problem, but just a delay in doing the tough job that we need to do of getting them out. So I'm not hopeful about that. And moreover, those small steps don't actually get you the administrative savings. So it'd be nice to think that we could get the bureaucratic savings that we need to provide universal coverage by doing this, but you don't. I mean, we have $350 billion each year wasted on insurance overhead and bureaucracy that they inflict on doctors and hospitals. But we're already doing almost all of our billing by computers. So the image that, oh, if we'll just computerize and streamline billing and that's how we'll save, that's not true. Hospitals, 95, 98% of hospitals are doing all of their billing on computers already. 80% of doctor bills are now sent on computers. So we're not going to save money by doing that. And even the low overhead plans of government today have much higher overhead than we could achieve under a real single payer system. So unfortunately, I wish there were an easy way to do this, but there's no sneaking in through the back door to get a good plan. I guess it's like a situation I face with many of my patients. And if they have a disease where there's a cure, but it's a difficult cure where we have to say, you know, you've got a cancer that chemotherapy can cure, it's tough and it's unpleasant treatment, but it can work. There are milder treatments, but they don't work, and I would be lying if I told you they do. And that's the case here, too, is these small, apparently easy incremental steps would be nice, but they don't do anything to actually cure the disease.
Well, I guess we can leave it there. Intriguing discussion. Dave Himmelstein and Judy Dugan, I'd like to thank you both so much for joining us on Public Health Radio.
Thank you.
Thanks very much, Marvin.
One final note. After today's show is recorded, the Bush administration released its budget proposal for the next fiscal year. That budget proposes large cuts in the federal contribution to the state Medicaid programs. As noted on today's news segment, these cuts threatened health insurance coverage for children across the country. But a key funding source, over 40%, for both the Massachusetts and California health reform proposals we discussed today, includes a big increase in the federal Medicaid contribution to these states. So if enacted, this federal budget would force a substantial scaling down of these reform proposals. Well, that's it for today's show. If you want to give us some feedback, or if you missed part of today's show and want to hear it, or want to tune into any of our previous shows, check out our website, publichealthradio.org. That's one word, publichealthradio.org. Thanks for listening, and join us again next month for another airing of Public Health Radio.